Monday, December 10th, LA Podcast. Scott Frazier, Alyssa Walker. I'm Hayes Davenport. We're going fast. We're blowing through these. We have a great conversation with Tommy Newman from Everyone In coming up at the end of the episode, just kind of summing up this year and what we've achieved in building housing for people who are homeless and keeping people out of homelessness. Everyone In is a great new program that works with United Way. That conversation was great. It's really exciting to leave, but we have a lot of stuff to get through. So we're blowing through it. Instead of LA stories, we thought this week we would each talk about this week was, Alyssa called it the Bill Blitz and the state legislature, which is when all the new legislators who are pretty much all Democrats now, and there's a lot more women than there were before. I think 10 new female legislators than there were last year. They're announcing their new bills.
New session started a week ago.
Yes.
You probably heard the
first day of school
air raid siren in the middle of the night when the bill blitz began. We now have hundreds of new potential laws to talk about.
And I think even from like a non-wonk perspective, there's some very exciting, wild shit in here. Would you agree with that?
The wild shit?
Yeah.
I would say so.
So we each are going to pick one to talk about. Alyssa, what is the hottest bill that's out there this cycle?
Well, I would say the hottest bill is SB 50, which we can maybe talk about later, which is the reboot of SB 827, which
Scott Wiener, former guest of the show.
Which, you know, we told you first he was bringing it back.
Yes.
And now he's bringing it back.
But it's different.
But it's different. And it seems to have not created the outrage and outroar initially,
at least,
as it did last time, which is good. So
yes, I like outroar.
Outroar. We'll talk about that in a deeper
future
detail
episode
later. But very relevant, I think, to a lot of the conversations that we've been having and some of the reports that have come out lately about emissions and vehicles and Californians and cars. Phil Ting wants to make sure that all new cars sold in California will be zero emission by 2040. This is AB 40. Get it? So, wow.
Yeah.
But also, it should be in 2 years, yes. Not 2040. So I don't know. Can we bump that one up and change the number?
I always feel like I saw Volkswagen this week said that their next generation of internal combustion engines will be their last. So I don't know. It feels like we could get a little more ambitious.
Do you really
on this,
trust
like you're
Volkswagen?
Have they ever lied to me before?
Have they ever done that? Well, if you look at European countries, and there's obviously a complicated narrative about combustion engines and gas and people using cars in Europe right now with riots in Paris. But let's think about if. That kind of is the way that you need to do it. Either a city or state needs to say you can't sell them here anymore or you can't buy them here anymore. And when we have such progressive emissions guidelines anyway and regulations in the state, I could see something like that happening as long as you're providing the transit to make sure people can get around and all these other options and, you know, build up the infrastructure. Hopefully that's all part of it. But 2040, I just got to say, it's just too far away. So hopefully maybe part of this conversation can be just ratcheting up the, you know, urgency and making sure that this starts to happen in, I don't know, can we just magically say I don't know how you start to implement it, right? We need to incentivize getting people into maybe used electric vehicles too. I mean, it's not just like new cars. We need to just make sure that everybody has access to these vehicles, starting with people who can't afford to buy new cars. So,
yep. We don't have time to get into the French gas protests, obviously, but I do worry that people listen to it and think like, oh, is this kind of like the gas taxes in California? And the main difference that I do want to point out is in France, they pay about 60% of their gas bill that goes to taxes. The amount of taxes they pay on gas is way, way higher than what we pay in the U.S. Their gas is like $6 a gallon, and like $3.75 of that goes to taxes.
Right.
And in the U.S., obviously, our gas is a lot cheaper and our tax burden now, even after the increase, is like 65, 70 cents or something. So it's like a whole nother level of cost. But that's just the one thing I wanted to get out of the way. Scott.
Okay, so the bill that I want to talk about today is Assembly Bill 53. This was co-authored by Assemblymembers Rob Bonta out of the East Bay in San Francisco region, and Reggie Jones Sawyer, who represents AD 59, which is historic South Central, Florence Graham, just generally a huge chunk of South LA. He didn't get the vaunted LA podcast endorsement. However, this is a great piece of legislation that he put forward on the first day of the session that proposes to ban landlords from not renting to an applicant for a housing unit because of a prior criminal offense. So this is like a ban the box type of legislation. We've had several of those either pass or be proposed in recent years. We had the AB 1008 that banned employers from taking into consideration previous criminal offenses. I think this is an exciting, not a whole ton of discussion to be had here. This is just something that is good to do. It's unreasonable to restrict housing based on people's past in such a way that will likely lead them into homelessness or not being able to afford a place to live in LA.
And so, ban the box refers to the box that you have to check if you're a felon on rent applications right now.
Correct.
Cool. I want to talk about AB 123, which is a universal pre-K measure. We've talked about on the show that this was something that the state was getting ready to do pretty soon. AB 123 is like a cutesy like kindergarten, like counting. Scott pointed that out to me. I never notice the cute things of the names. They always go over my head. This is a big bill for LA. There's a lot of evidence that the gap in pre-K attendance mostly falls on Latino families. 66% of kids under five in LA County are Latino. So this would have a very meaningful impact in this area. It does seem like it's going to be means tested, which means that it's only going to go towards families that fall under a certain standard of income, which is a little annoying. The current much more limited pre-K programs in California are already means tested. And I read a KPCC story a while ago about a woman whose kids didn't qualify for the free pre-K programs because her husband made $600 a week. I think the lower limit was something like $30,000 a year in income. And if you're at $31,000, you still can't afford paid preschool. Right. So you're just kind of...
I would say it several times, yes. That income you still cannot afford.
I would say that there's obviously a ton that needs to be hashed out with this bill still. This yeah. one, this AB 123, being that it does come out of the Assembly, it falls under the category of what Anthony Rendon, Speaker of the Assembly, said earlier about a week ago, where he was saying basically like, yeah, we don't want to pay for really rich people to send their kids to preschool. I imagine that the Senate will have some things to say about that, and there will be a good deal of back and forth about how this should actually be structured.
Okay, yeah, because it's written into the language now that it's targeted at the lowest income income people. And this woman ended up having to game the system and declaring her own income independently to prove that their family was poor enough to get a kid into this free program. So it would be good to avoid those kind of situations with this bill. Good. Hot bills. We're moving. Other exciting transit news. Congestion pricing is now on the table. Alyssa, you went to a Metro meeting this week where Metro Chair Phil Washington was talking about congestion pricing. What did you hear?
Well, so I was not actually at the Metro meeting, but I was at a meeting in the same room just moments before. No, a couple days before. So Phil Washington, the CEO of Metro, has been making the speaking rounds. He was on my panel at LA Commotion. He's been, you know, talking across the county at all these big events and transit events, talking at the NACTO conference earlier this fall, and has just been saying a lot of really great stuff. Like, you see everybody in the room, their ears kind of perk up when the head of, you know, our transportation agency says things like, we need to drive less, we need to get people out of their cars, I need my buses to move faster, I need, you know, he's just really, he's hitting the talking points really good. So at the meeting for the Air Resources Board with the California Transportation Commission, where they're supposed to get together and figure out why their climate goals and their transportation goals aren't aligning, and that's because they keep just building freeways and, you know, what, yeah, I don't have to explain this. So he gets up at the beginning of this meeting and gives like this really awesome presentation, and everybody in the room is very excited with what he's saying. And then a couple days later, he goes into this Metro board meeting and says, we need to make transit free for everyone. Because before we came into this meeting, there was this big conversation about how we're going to pay for all these projects for the Olympics, yeah, this 28 by 28
like,
list.
Raise fares.
Yeah. So they were kind of like floated this idea, like we need to raise fares or need to do all these other things. And he walks in and is just like, I want to make transit free for everybody. And the way we're going to do it is that we're going to forever. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But forever. And the way we're going to do it is we're going to charge drivers to drive in our city. And that's, I was literally jumping up and down. I mean,
I was actually, I have a complicated relationship with the, with Phil Washington in the role of CEO. I was greatly enthused by this. It was a kind of amazing thing to even hear the CEO of the second largest municipal transit operator in the country say out loud in a public forum that he wants to make drivers pay for providing free transit to everybody. It's a radical proposal for
America. We've talked about
America.
It before, but congestion pricing is just basically the idea that you pay a toll to drive into the city. They do it in London. They have kind of a ring system.
There are multiple ways to do it. One of the most common way is exactly what you're saying. You have a geometric cordon, and whenever somebody crosses a specific line in or out, then they're going to pay a toll of some kind. But using that money to actually make transit free, I think one of the things that we've seen really clearly is that people use transit when the barriers to using transit are low. Also when the quality goes up, but making it free for everybody all the time, forever, throughout the Metro service area would be like nothing short of revolutionary for the LA region.
It would be huge. But I will say at the same time, to have it be equitable, even if transit were free right now, a lot of people to do their jobs, a lot of low income people would still have to drive into the city. So you need to expand transit opportunities and you need to build more housing in the city center where the jobs are simultaneously with congestion pricing, which is still a great idea.
And what was cool about it was that during the public comment at the end, all the profs from UCLA, like Juan Matute, like they got up there and they're like, we will help you design the program that addresses all these equitable concerns. Cause that is a big part of it. And it's been done, you know, you can have exemptions for low income workers, things like that. It's all good. And the other things that's exciting to think about is, you know, we already kind of do this. We have these hot lanes or whatever you call them. What do they call them? Fast track.
Yeah.
We have these and they're fueling some of the, you know, most popular transit service. Things like the Silver Line is actually doing really well, which kind of mirrors that same corridor. And I also want to point out something announced at the Metro board meeting was that when they did make transit free on election day, which was not very heavily promoted maybe and kind of, you know, just something that they did for fun. Boardings went up 5%.
Wow.
And bike ridership on a Metro bike went up 13%.
That's big. Exciting. Oh my God, whose music is that? Quasar. Say it ain't so.
I love it.
I had to add my new verse to that I texted you guys about last week that I was really pissed that I didn't get on the last episode, which is, okay, so you play the part that goes, say it ain't so, my wife is a fundraiser.
So good.
Jose Huizar's the embattled city council member, still being investigated by the FBI. We still don't know exactly what for. His office has canceled Night on Broadway, the most exciting night of the year for
Broadway.
Jose Huizar's office.
That's true. Yes.
Last year, I remember my feed was full of like all the council members dressed up to go see the B-52s who were performing on Night on Broadway last year. They clearly just are having the time of their lives and they get to go like get on stage in front of all these people. Canceled. Coming back in January 2020.
They say.
And the speculation was that the office dealing with all these investigations just wouldn't have time to do this event,
which seems true.
Yes, and at least
seems
you wonder
extremely true.
What do they? What else do they not have time for? And is it time to get someone else in there who would potentially not be weighed down by FBI investigations?
But I also want to say Scott had the best tweet of the situation during the week, which was, when Huizar does leave office, does that mean we can take the money designated to the streetcar?
Does anybody else still want the downtown streetcar? Jose Huizar is the sole proponent, seemingly, for a streetcar that would run in one direction in a loop, as we talked about, through
on
downtown.
Broadway.
Slightly slower than walking speed. And if you want to go back the other way, then you're going to, I guess, walk or whatever. So he did manage to get $200 million of Measure M money put in there for the streetcar. It's not a real transit project. When he leaves, we should think seriously about getting
rid
of that.
Well, if Night on Broadway is being postponed until 2020, that means the streetcar is being postponed to like 2070.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't worry about you personally having to deal with it. We also have heard a lot of rumors that Kevin DeLeon is about to announce his candidacy for CD14.
And when asked point blank about it by Emily Alpert-Reyes from the LA Times, he did not, or his office did not deny that he was considering that, just said that they were looking into ways to continue to serve the public. So if you want to end up in the mayor's office in LA, being a city council member is a reasonable way to do it.
Yeah. And a lot of people have pointed out that he did not beat Dianne Feinstein for Senate in that district, even in his home district. But he's not going to be running against Dianne Feinstein.
He's not going to be running against Dianne Feinstein. Yeah.
As far as we know. Alyssa, The Curbed published an article this week about Malibu. We considered doing a funny, like we do for Beverly Hills 90210, a funny Malibu theme song. But I think we wait until a little longer after the fires to do a funny theme song. We don't want to kick them while they're down. But they have said next time there's a fire, they will not be leaving.
Yeah, there was this very contentious city council meeting earlier this week where a bunch, you know, they have these debriefings after these emergency events, and I get it. They have a lot of questions and they want to know, you know, they ask the first responders and the firefighters and the sheriff's department all these questions. And basically, after, you know, this line of questioning about why were we evacuated? Why were we not evacuated fast enough? Why was there traffic on the PCH? Why did you, I don't know, do all these things? The question about, like, why were we told to leave our homes and then you didn't protect my home kept coming up, with one woman just saying, like, you told me to leave and then I had to watch my house burn on the news or something, and nobody was there. There were no fire trucks there. There was nobody there to save my house.
But that is, it sounds like that is why they told her to leave,
also,
at least,
like,
part
yeah,
of it.
It's I don't good think, reason to get I don't think the deal is to save your house. I think the deal is to save your life.
Yeah.
And I think that they did a good job with that. Only three people died in the Woolsey fire. So I think there, this general thought, and kind of at the meeting, it was like, if you stayed, you were a hero. If you didn't evacuate,
yes,
if you chose to stay there and protect your property. And then, you know, some people, even the incoming mayor, got like burned. Zuma J, not to be confused with Zuma Dog. Got like burned and was, yes, in the hospital. You know, so it's a very dangerous thing that you're not supposed to do. And so a lot of people said, next time I'm not leaving, I will never evacuate again because you did this to us. And people were saying, we don't get taken care of. This is a civil rights violation. And some really shocking things. But I mean, I have to say the firefighting resources were definitely stretched thin at the time. And the captains of the fire department even said this, like, a team from Southern California had gone up to the campfire to, like, that day or something to help fight those fires. But I'll reiterate, the firefighters did a great job and saved a lot of structures, but they're not really there to save your house, mm-hmm, and watch outside your house to make sure your, you know, pool stays intact or something. I mean, I don't
Maybe
know.
Maybe our Malibu segment should be every quote spoken in Hayes's Pitch Perfect, Pierce Brosnan. Just clip in some famous Malibu residents.
I mean, this is really dangerous because I remember when my in-laws were evacuated from Santa Barbara during the fires, not like a surprisingly small number of structures ended up getting burned. I don't think anyone died in like the Santa Barbara, Carpinteria area in the Thomas fire. And then when they had them evacuate again during the rain, during the mudslides, a lot of people didn't leave.
Yeah. And then people died.
Yeah. Yes. Leave. You just have to leave.
You just have to leave. And I think that this question that, you know, resources are there to protect your house is a lot of this like private firefighter conversation we've been having on the side. I don't know. We've talked about it here, but like there are these stories about how all these gated communities are promising like access to a firefighting team. And that's why some neighborhoods got saved. And these are the conversations that these communities are having, mm-hmm. That they want to have these private firefighting teams, which some of the fire, like are the city and county firefighters have said can get in the way of what they're doing and their operations. Yeah. And so I think like the resource allocation, I'm not saying that anybody did anything wrong or the fire department did anything wrong, but their expectations that there should somehow be a fire truck outside of everybody's home.
As soon as
the fire starts, like it's just parked there waiting for them. And that it's really not about saving your home. Once again, it's really just making sure that everybody gets out alive, which they did. Mm-hmm. I don't know what to say. It was a pretty intense meeting.
A little more political position shuffling this week. Herb Wesson, council president, council member from District 10, has announced that he is going to be running for county supervisor for County District 2. And that's the district that is currently occupied by Mark Ridley Thomas. They overlap. It's in kind of like central and south central L.A. This Herb Wesson was a guy that was seen as potentially running for mayor. Mm-hmm. So this clears the field a little bit for the next mayoral election. But he might be replaced by Mark Ridley Thomas, who may have decided that he wants to run for mayor from the council instead of from the county. These are both guys who are like sort of legendary in LA local politics. Mm-hmm. We've talked for both of them. About a couple, we haven't talked about Herb Wesson scandals that much. There haven't been that many compared to some with Mark Ridley Thomas and his son. But what it says to me is some people like kind of potentially just lining themselves up for the mayoral election, which the timeline for that has been moved a little bit as well, because Eric Garcetti said that he was going to decide about a presidential run by the end of the year, and that has been moved to early 2019. Just to update you on where that is at. This past Thursday, Metro announced its operating plan for the Crenshaw line. Scott was using like a heavy bag all week, like getting ready for the Crenshaw plan to come out. And now it's out. You speculated that the plan might be dumb. Were you surprised?
No, it's dumb. It's actually worse than what I had, not when I told you that it was going to be dumb, but it's dumber than the original dumb plan that Janice Hahn's office seemed like they were going to support, which would be to basically force the Crenshaw line to serve both the South Bay and also the legacy Green Line, so that South Bay residents could get direct access to the Expo line. They're not doing that. Instead, the plan that is now board approved and will go forward for a 1-year pilot period is that the Green Line will serve both the current route, which goes from Norwalk to the South Bay, Redondo Beach, through the aerospace office parks of El Segundo, and also the newly built Crenshaw line. So it will branch off, one branch going south and another branch going north towards the Expo line. With the Green Line, the main part of it that's in the 105 freeway, having trains every 3 minutes during rush hour so that each of those branches can get service every 6 minutes during rush hour. Mm-hmm. Normally, I'm the guy on Twitter who's like, trains need to be more frequent. That yep. sounds like a good
that's
idea,
good.
Right?
Yeah.
It doesn't sound like a good idea because First of all, the South Bay portion of the Green Line, nobody rides. This is, it was actually, I thought I was going to just vibrate into a million pieces while I was listening to the board meeting, hearing Director Hilda Solis, who is a county supervisor as well, representing East LA, Southeast LA, say that her concern was for the 500 people that would have a 7 minute longer ride under the Metro staff proposal, which is to turn the South Bay portion of the Green Line into a shuttle that goes up to the Century stop, Century and Aviation, allowing people to transfer to LAX. And then if they so chose, then transfer back down to the Green Line to the 105 serving segment. 500 people would be inconvenienced, and Hilda Solis was very troubled by that, and so signed on with five other board members to a motion by Janice Hahn, who does represent the South Bay, and felt like this was a shuttle to a shuttle, I think was her catchphrase that she had at the board. She fully ignored vocally the staff recommendation that said that her plan and the plan that eventually a majority of the board members agreed to would pose considerable issues for service because the Green Line was never built to support those frequencies with the three car sets of trains. So
how
now
do you vocally ignore something?
She actually said, I don't believe that what you're saying is actually a problem. I don't believe that it would affect service. Staff said you will probably see trains lose power along the entirety of the Green Line. The Crenshaw Line now can no longer support three car trains. It can only support two car trains. So we just spent, that's right, $2 billion on a train. We've already cut service by one third. It's kind of like the opposite, you know, that like the Flight 93 election thing. It's like the opposite. It's like if you had the pilots revolt and just be like, I'm crashing this fucking plane.
Is there could this be reversed? Like, could
it
this
is a
be
1 year pilot period? Janice Hahn is very bad at being coy or candid or not being candid about what she's thinking. So she has already said she would like to see this continued forever. And that this is going to be something that she wants to be the operating structure of the Green Line from here on out. But at this moment, it is a 1 year pilot. So enjoy your terrible commutes. The 500 people in the South.
Congratulations.
Bay, you are it's just the favor of God shines down upon you. I don't know what else to say.
Anecdotally, I went out to El Segundo on the Green Line the other day, and I sent you guys a video of me in my completely empty car, and the car next to me was empty as well.
Alyssa compared it to Snowpiercer, which I liked.
Very briefly, Omar Navarro, the undefeated loser who ran against Maxine Waters for the last congressional election, who associates with a lot of alt-right people, including some avowed Nazis. It came out that he, in his last campaign, was paying himself campaign contributions, paying himself a salary, which is unusual.
And, to say the least.
And some legal experts were unsure whether this was legal or not because it's just something that is very rarely done. I think it's hard for him to get another job because he was arrested recently for planting a tracking device on his wife's car. He's not really worth talking about on this show because he has no local constituency whatsoever. His grift is for a national audience. Right. He has like a bunch of Twitter followers and he goes on like whatever the equivalent of InfoWars, and he is currently soliciting money for his 2020 campaign against Maxine Waters.
Bless. So,
yes, bless. Good that to know that where that's going.
It's kind of like the producers, right? Like, they said in the article, like, they're not going to look into it because he lost so big, sort of thing.
Well,
it is like kind of like, well, you know.
It's a full time job to be such a loser.
Yeah. And a little news in the sheriff's department. Alex Villanueva, not content with lopping off the entire top of the sheriff's department, has notified 500 employees of the department that their jobs are essentially up for review.
Right.
Not necessarily that he's going to fire a bunch more people, but he's going to be doing a lot of restructuring. Yeah. There's a great profile. We can't go an episode without mentioning Maya Lau. She and one
I
other.
I would love to see a word cloud for our podcast. Maya Lau.
She of the LA Times and one other person whose name escapes me now teamed up on a great profile of Alex Villanueva this week that presented him as a very headstrong, ambitious guy and kind of always has been. I learned a lot from this profile kind of about his background. He has always been kind of a troublemaker within the sheriff's department and like sometimes in positive.
Marissa Gerber.
He started his own deputies union, which I didn't know when he was a deputy that is still, that still exists.
Kicking around.
Yeah. He's a fascinating guy. It's a huge move before I believe he has now technically been sworn in. He was sworn in by, MC Big Boy. The other day he was, the Big Boy was in attendance. He was emceeing,
crowd full of luminaries that
day. Yes. And so I don't know. It'd be interesting to see what happens there. All right, let's go to our conversation with the great Tommy Newman from Everyone In.
All right. We have a very special guest today, kind of an end of the year segment, I feel like, so we can look at how far we've come or perhaps how far we still need to go.
Take stock.
Yeah, take stock of a very important issue that we talk about a lot on the podcast. We have Tommy Newman from United Way's Everyone In campaign. You work for United Way, but you are joined the Everyone In campaign when it launched and you've been kind of running it on the ground, right?
Yeah, so I would think of Everyone In as sort of a baby of United Way that sort of sits on its own with its own communications channels, its own sort of infrastructure. It's an unsupervised baby. Yep. And it's mine. I'm honored to have the responsibility, and we launched it back in March of this year.
Is it funded by, you know, H and HHH measures? Like, this is where the funding kind of like makes this baby?
No, we're privately funded from a lot of great philanthropies and towns, foundations, individuals. And so, no, we're not receiving any of those funds standalone from that.
That allows you to speak truth to power in a way that we've kind of talked about on the show. You guys are running a count, for example, of each council member, how many units of permanent supportive housing they've built in their district. I love it. You can just go to this website. What's the website that the
everyoneinla.org?
.org. And you can see the actual numbers next to their faces. Mm-hmm. Shame. Public shame on the internet.
Some of them
love scorecards. Yeah. Yes.
And it's even better than that. They all, to their credit, took a pledge to that number. Mm-hmm. So we drafted a concept and we took it to City Hall and we went from office to office and we said, what do you guys think? 222 units in each district by July 2020, a total of 3,330, a third of our goal towards HHH. And they were like, let's do it. And I don't think that they expected to have a website with their faces on it. And
right.
Doing what we
they were agreeing to that.
What other websites can we make with faces on them?
But it's one of our favorite things that we've done. So yeah, accountability, transparency, but also just a baseline of education. Nobody, you know, this is such a daunting issue that to help people sort of break it into smaller pieces and understand it, we really see that as a core responsibility for what we're doing.
So tell us, first of all, about that goal. Let's talk about, I mean, the underlying reason that we are the 222 exist was that we have to create 10,000 units as part of, you know, the city mandate. And now we've been saying that might not happen for various reasons on recent shows. So what are we on track? What do we need to do to, first of all, work on the permanent supportive housing? Then we'll talk about some of the other things like temporary housing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a great question. So we have two ballot measures that have passed. Your highly engaged audience knows this, HHH and H. HHH intended to build supportive housing, which is appropriate for people who have experienced homelessness chronically or have a long-term disability. So supportive housing, and this is something we get in community meetings a lot. How could we possibly build enough supportive housing for every single person experiencing homelessness? That's not the goal. That's not the challenge. To the city's credit, it crafted HHH through a lot of sort of good hard pushing from the outside to focus on those who are the most vulnerable, in the worst shape, or have the longest history of homelessness. And what we know is we need about 20,000 units across the county of supportive housing. So HHH would get us, if everything went well, halfway there. We still need to figure out how we bridge that gap and create that supply of supportive housing that's commensurate with the challenge and the need out there. It's really only about a third of the people who are experiencing homelessness that are appropriate for supportive housing. Two thirds of the people experiencing homelessness just need a place they can't afford, because of course our housing crisis is our homelessness crisis. Okay, so that's the big picture. Zooming in, where are we? 3,000 units approved for funding so far, 2,800 of them supportive. There's an ability to build very low income, affordable as part of HHH, and so sometimes that gets worked in there. So that's good, right? So out of the gate, a lot of great projects, a lot of great support. We always focus on the negative. So I think most people assume, you know, that everything's getting stopped and we barely have any. Nearly 3,000 units of supportive housing is a big deal.
Most of what we've talked about on this show has typically been the blowups that make it into the news, where whether it's going to be a specific community such as Koreatown or Sherman Oaks pushing back against any kind of homeless sighting of housing in their community or something like that. That is typically what we do end up talking about. So I think people do get the sense that everybody everywhere is trying to stop this from happening. It's really good to hear that 2,800 units are already approved.
Yeah.
What is the timeline, or what is the process from approval to actually getting people into those 2,800 units?
Yeah, it's a great point. And I would say that's generally the media narrative. Conflict usually drives. There's the phrase for local news that doesn't apply to all outlets. If it bleeds, it leads. Right? So like that's where you go.
Ours is, if it bleeds, it doesn't necessarily lead, but it is in there.
Yeah, it's gonna be there. Yeah. It's gonna be right in that story. And so, you know, when Steve Lopez goes and writes a column, he picks the three fights that are happening, Pasadena, West LA, and Venice. And then everybody reads that and they're like, well, we're all screwed. We're fucked. We can't do it.
Right.
So I try to have a little bit of more positivity, because it's real. So I'm not, you know, BSing. Yep. These are things that have funding letters of commitment, and smart, reputable nonprofit developers are going to build them. And they've been doing it for a long time. And finally, they have more resources to do more. That's great. They're in various stages. So they're 500 units under construction right now. They're probably about another 1,000 that'll be in construction in the next 6 months. And then it sort of filters out from there based on where they're at. To get HHH funds, they have to have the land secured. So it's not like they've got the money and now they're trying to figure out where to build it, if that gives you a little bit more certainty. One of the things we did change, though, in HHH is it used to be that the city would put its money in last. So a developer would come and say, okay, we've got all the money and we just need a little more from the city of LA. To get this going faster, the city is the first dollars in. So they get this letter of commitment, which is usually about 40 to 50% of the total cost of the project. And then they have to go find the rest of the money, usually from tax credits at the state level or maybe some other grants or the county. So that's why it sort of shakes out. It's not like they get the HHH and then they put the shovels in the ground. The idea was to stretch the HHH as far as possible. And so that was something else that nobody understands or is aware of. And it's a good thing, right? Like various pots of money leveraging each other gets us more units. The city could easily pay for 100% of the cost of the building, but we would get far less buildings if we did it that way.
One potential positive, I think, of focusing on battlegrounds is that it does point people who want more supportive housing in the city of like the next places to like help support a project. What are some going up now that might need a little extra boost from neighbor, like people that live in the area who want these projects to go up?
Yeah, I'd say closest to where we are sitting right now would be Echo Park, where Mitch O'Farrell has sort of stepped forward and said, I want to take this piece of land that the city of Los Angeles owns and make it available for housing. That's always hard in the city of LA and in Southern California. Every piece of land probably has some history to it. Some interest group will have opinions about what's going to happen there. And so in this case, a next door neighbor there is a longstanding community organization that's been using the piece of land for recreation purposes for the kids who participate in its programs. And so the council office has made a commitment to maintain enough use, not necessarily amount of space, because we can't both build a building and keep the basketball and handball courts. But they've made a commitment to say, okay, what if it was a combined basketball handball court and we carve that out. And so we always try to find our way through. That's one meeting. Actually, I don't know when we're going to air here, but on
it's on tomorrow.
Perfect. Tuesday, December 11th.
Yep.
We'll be over next door to the site, actually, just right there next to Echo Park, starting at 6 o'clock. And so that's one example. Venice has a whole lot going on.
Yep.
If you're on the west side, again, a good example. Mike Bonin made a giant parking lot available, 120,000 square feet. That's a big parking lot. And the community isn't thrilled about that being proposed. So the best way to sort of keep in contact on these issues is to sign up at everyoneinla.org. Put your zip in, because your zip is how we'll sort what emails we send to you based on what's going on in what communities. And so we'll both try to help you understand what these issues are, what the solutions are, and then give you sort of easy, clear ways to get engaged.
Yeah, and I have to say the resources are great, not just going and checking the leaderboard every week as I do to see how the standings change.
Week,
yeah,
so
it's really exciting. But just to understand and get these things explained to you and to know that there are, you provide really good reasons for why things are happening. And so it's good like talking points if you're trying to talk to someone else about in their neighborhood and what's happening. Let's talk quickly about the temporary housing, the bridge housing, which is not, it's different. And can you explain just why it's different and why maybe the I don't want to say the battle, I don't want to say the fight, but like why the conversation is different?
Sure. I think when you're talking about homelessness as a challenge, you need to think of the solutions in the context of a system. And so what we're trying to build right now in LA through Measure H primarily is a system that is of the scale and capacity that it needs to be at to deal with a crisis of this size. And so for decades, we only had federal dollars. The city was only spending money on LAPD and sanitation. The county every so often had additional dollars, but mostly was using its health system and the sheriff department to do this work. And so over the last 10 years, we've tested and piloted what a system would need to be. And a system is enough outreach and engagement. So those are folks who are out on the street, who are trained and able to build relationships and trust to bring people indoors. Enough short-term safe places for people to sleep, but it's not at a one-to-one ratio because you want to be turning those beds over. And then enough permanent affordable housing at the end of that arc, both supportive and regularly affordable, to meet the needs. Right. And so for far too long, I mean, LA has just, I think everybody knows this, but I'll say it again. 75% of the people experiencing homelessness live outside in the county of Los Angeles.
Are not sheltered on a nightly basis.
Which is unacceptable. Yeah. Right. And so the challenge then becomes, how do we solve that challenge while still building a system? So very commonly we hear we need to treat this like an earthquake and we need to have, you know, every park with big tents set up on it and bringing everybody in to those tents. And the challenge with that is that would basically be all of the Measure H resources. There's been good analysis to show if we were going to try to have a bed for every single person who's living outside, it would basically cost us all of the Measure H money and more.
Right.
Which is, I don't think, the outcome that everybody wants. I think everybody wants to see a thoughtful strategy that connects people to permanent housing.
A more sustainable approach.
Because that's how you break the cycle of homelessness and poverty.
I see a lot of misconceptions about people saying it would cost $1 billion or something dollars to eliminate homelessness in Los Angeles, but that's what it costs to put everyone under a tent. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't affect the homelessness numbers at all. Those people are still without permanent resources.
This is where things get wonky here, right? So you're still technically homeless when you're in short-term housing of that sort. And I know that's hard to articulate and hard to hear. And so our answer is not like, well, we just need to leave folks outside and they need to wait. Like, no, that's not the answer. The answer is we need to get better at creating more long-term permanent affordable housing. We need to do it faster and we need to connect people into it faster. That's what we need to do. So back to the actual question, bridge housing. And it's different than a shelter. And here we are getting real wonky again. A shelter is line up at 5 p.m., sleep there overnight, get kicked out at 8 a.m., come back the next day, line up at 5 p.m. That's not what we're proposing to do. Measure H invests a large amount of money. It's one of the biggest pots of funding in Measure H in bridge housing, which is 24/7. So you're not kicked out the next day. And really intensive on-site supportive services that are focused on permanent housing placement. And so those are two tweaks to a traditional shelter model, which are critically important. So we're trying to create another 2,000 of those beds. right now. That's what's happening. So the Mayor's Bridge Home Program is sort of a branded program that fits into this narrative. It's funded by Measure H, and it's helping get people into these beds. And you want to turn them over at least four times a year if you possibly can. Of course, the challenges do have permanent housing for people to go to. So again, conflict is leading on this one. The county has added 900 bridge beds over the last 12 months without much to do. Expanding capacity at existing locations, firing places back up that were shut down because they didn't have enough money to do it.
Where are some locations that they've put new beds in?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of a spread out across the county, a lot in South LA, to be sure. San Gabriel Valley has picked up some additional beds. Sort of Palmdale Lancaster has picked up a ton of beds. So in places where the county already had a footprint, which is good and which is helpful. And we would like to do this with the least amount of friction possible. I'm somebody who's trying to avoid the conflict. I'm somebody who's trying to like find the way through and get there.
Yep.
Because we don't need to be getting in big fights about all this stuff. So there have been some fights, and that's what we can talk about here shortly. Mostly related to the Mayor's Bridge Home Program, which is not expanding capacity at existing facilities, but creating new where there was not something before, which then requires a ton of educating. You know, everything that I just said and what we've talked about is step one in the conversation. And then people have a lot more questions after that. And because it looks and feels different than an apartment building, we are now in the interesting place where people are like, okay, well, I don't really want this bridge housing, but could we just build supportive housing instead? That'd be great.
Yeah.
So it's a tricky place.
It sounds like, and this is something that undoubtedly you deal with a lot, but something that people that are only familiar in a passing sense with the issue of homelessness as it exists in Los Angeles might not be familiar with this notion that there are basically like different strata in homelessness. There are different pathways through which people find themselves in homelessness, different durations for which individual spells of homelessness can last for groups or families. So whereas you might have families who are, we've talked about on this program, falling out of the bottom of the rental housing market, who can no longer afford rent. You might have people with longstanding mental health or addiction issues. You might have people with a variety of causes that see them end up on the street. And each of those people, based on their individual circumstances, is going to require a different type of housing. So everyone in is focused, I would imagine. And that, is that something that distinguishes you from the broader United Way effort, is that you have this focus of bridge housing and people who are looking for permanent supportive housing specifically?
Yeah, I would say, there is not, and we saw a pretty clear need, for an advocacy group focused primarily on supportive. When we first launched Everyone In, we did not expect to be spending a large amount of our time on bridge. Turned out we have been, and we're happy to do it because it's important, as long as we're articulating how it fits into the system and we're not sort of going headlong and not thinking about the implications of the strategy and what we're trying to do. We have a team of 10 community organizers who are working on the ground, and we're just rolling out a series right now that's focusing on each one of them, sort of telling their story and why they do their work. We'll post our first video on it this week. We've been doing sort of different social posts with their picture and a little bit about them. Those organizers' job is to own a region of this county and to build relationships with existing community-based organizations, advocacy groups, regular folks, and be that sort of conduit into this conversation. And it's now up to 10 people. It's one of the larger organizing teams that's operating in the county right now, and it's the only one focused on bridge and supportive housing. We don't exclude affordable in every one of, and unless I miss my copying editing responsibilities, you'll always see supportive and affordable housing, because we don't want to create the misperception that supportive is the solution to all of it. But we see bridge and supportive as two directly funded HHH&H programs. So they have the resources, but that doesn't guarantee that they'll happen. And two that are often the most misunderstood, and where good educating can take people out of that mushy middle and turn them into supporters. So one thing I would add on that, and this was sort of the call to action for our campaign, we did a poll in January 2018 of June likely voters. People who vote in primary elections are not normal people. These are people who are reading the news. These are people who know who their council member is, which is not the majority of people in the
city. Basically all of our listeners.
I was going to say, everybody gets a gold star who's listening to this right now. And so we asked a bunch of questions, but the one that's most relevant here is, suppose that housing for the homeless was proposed in your neighborhood. Would you support or oppose such a proposal? And so normally we never say the homeless. That is not the best practice because you've just sort of dehumanized and taken the humanity out of it. Mm-hmm. Housing for the homeless, we didn't say supportive housing. And so we didn't get into the specifics. When you use the phrase supportive housing, support goes way up because people are like, oh, it's housing, but it's supportive. Mm. This is why we tried to drop the permanent. Nobody else in the country calls it permanent supportive housing.
Okay.
And the permanent is a real obstacle to people understanding. They're like, what does a permanent mean? And like, does that mean that it might not be permanent? And you just go down this rabbit hole and it's super weird. So make things easier on yourself. So here's the quiz for the day. What percentage of people do you think said yes in that poll? Remember, these are June voters.
80%.
This is an optimist.
That is way too high, I think. I would say 65.
Hmm. Yeah, I would have guessed 60.
Really?
Yeah.
So I was at the American Planning Association conference a couple weeks ago and I did this and the planners were like, historically abused folks, right? Like they're just like deep in the worst of it. And the audience was like 2%, 7%. And I was like, oh, I'm so sorry guys for your daily existence of trying to do land use and planning.
Well, it's a poll. People are much more generous in polls than they are in an actual ballot.
Perhaps 69%.
So okay. That's great.
That's good.
And
27% said no. And so my takeaway there was we give too much credit to the 27%. Steve Lopez needs to stop writing columns about the 27% every other week. It's not the whole, but
his good intentions.
He does. And he lives in the neighborhood, so we have to be careful. but we need to unlock that 69%. We need to make it easy for that 69% to get involved in this conversation. That is the call to action for everyone in. And that's what we are consistently focused on. How are we tapping into those folks and creating those on-ramps into the conversation?
And going back to bridge housing for a second, I know for me personally, in terms of like getting into that debate, it's made a little more difficult by the punitive aspect that the mayor has kind of implied as part of it. If you don't go into shelter in certain neighborhoods where these new bridge housing units are going up, you will potentially be arrested for sleeping on the sidewalk. And that kind of makes me feel like if these units are going, do I want these units to go up if more people are going to be arrested because of it? Have you guys weighed in on the enforcement aspect of bridge housing at all?
Yeah, we certainly have. We think that outreach workers, trained professionals who know how to engage with folks who are living outside is going to be the most effective way to get folks into those. And that there doesn't need to be the, you know, threat of arrest. We don't think that that really changes the equation in the long run. And so we're pretty vocal and honest about that. And, you know, we have to give them credit. El Pueblo, now known as El Puente. There was a name change there.
Oh, that's right. I did notice that. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the one by Alvera Street for
correct.
People. Yeah.
The business owners at Alvera Street, requested that it be called something else other than El Pueblo. There have not been any arrests related to folks, you know, not complying with the ordinances that the city is enforcing, which have been on the books for a long time. So I think that it's shown us that arrest does not need to be a component of this. Everybody knows that it doesn't actually help. And so far, so good on that front. But yeah, no, outreach led is the term. Mm-hmm. And that's what it always should be. Now, some outreach workers would tell you that it's sometimes helpful to have law enforcement there as part of the conversation for their own safety or as sort of a component of, you know, where this can go and what the options are. So I wouldn't say that we should exclude law enforcement from the conversation entirely. Sometimes law enforcement has better relationships than outreach workers do, based on past histories of trauma or violence or that people have experienced living outside. So law enforcement should be part of the conversation, but they should not be leading this conversation. I actually had a chance to sit down with the LAPD chief a couple of weeks back, and he's like, oh, we would love to not be part of any of this.
Is that true? Because they've asked for a lot more money from Prop H funding for services, and they are currently the number one homeless outreach provider in the city. Mm-hmm. So how do we go about getting some of those services out of the police department and putting them towards... Yeah. Like LASA and other outreach programs.
They didn't get any funding out of Measure H. They wanted
I was just saying they asked. Yeah.
Yes, that's true. They asked. Did not receive. I would say no longer are they the number one outreach team anymore. We now have census tract coverage of every census tract in the county by an assigned outreach team. And there's some really cool maps that'll show you a spa. Those are the areas that the county is divided into, and then which teams are assigned to which regions within those spas. It's going to take a while before we all really feel and see that on a regular basis, but it's a really special moment to acknowledge, and we should acknowledge that we finally have outreach team coverage of the whole county.
And we have talked before on the show about an app that you can use. Mm-hmm. And I will say, I mean, I have used it to try to get help for someone and I got called back.
Really?
And the person came to my house and talked to me, the outreach worker, to get more information, which within 2 days.
That's
so
cool.
It was such an amazing experience. And to talk, I was just like, I just want to talk to you and like find out about your job. And obviously they keep it very, confidential between the client and them. But, it was just a really great experience to know that somebody, that nights it was super cold and rainy and I was worried. And
so let's talk about that. So there is an app. Mm-hmm. I think this ties back into what you were saying earlier, Tommy, which was that we want to figure out ways to get the 69% of people who are generally supportive of housing for homeless individuals in their neighborhood, how to get them involved in the conversation. So I was curious to hear your thoughts on what that looks like for them to be engaged in the conversation, where those conversations are happening. And if you could give us a basis for what is this app that you have out that Alyssa has used. I haven't seen it. So I would like to hear about how that works and how people can find and use it.
Yeah. I would distinguish the app is the county and losses, not United Ways or Everyone Inns. It's intended to be a way for folks to request outreach support specifically for a given encampment or person. It's the first time that the county / LASA has ever attempted anything like this. Because it didn't have the resources to follow up on those requests in the past. So it didn't even want to sort of open that door. I'd say that we were all hesitant when it first launched. What sort of expectations would it set? Could they be met? Is it the best way to do outreach and engagement? So these outreach and engagement teams are out there building relationships, checking in with folks on a regular basis. That is more relationship based and strategy based, as opposed to, and this is usually what happens with apps like this, the squeaky wheel thing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, who's going to be the person who uses the app all the time and calls in the same encampment all the time because it really gets under their skin? And what would that do for resource allocation? So those are all concerns and continue to be concerns about how the app works. We have been sort of, I think, pleasantly surprised that the volume has been manageable, that it hasn't been, people trying the same 10 people trying to use it to harass the same 10 people. So that's been good to see. And so I think it's a work in progress. It's, it hasn't even been around for 6 months at this point.
I feel like they haven't really even gotten the word out about it yet. And they maybe are just starting to. But I did worry about that, too. I was like, are people just going to use this like the 311 type response where you're just reporting the loud neighbor's music?
But even if it replaces 911, that's right. Shift.
Exactly. Like I you don't want people to be harassed and you don't want this to be another way for people to, like you said, kind of report the same few people over and over. But I was amazed at the depth of what you could explain and the conversation and the follow-up that happened. So, and obviously these outreach workers already know who these people are. I mean, it's not like they're going to be like, oh, of course, they know these blocks very well in every neighborhood.
Yeah. I mean, the outreach thing is critically important component of the system. But one of the things that I usually say, because people are like, well, how many times are they going to come out and talk to somebody? And how long is that really going to take? And this is where sort of just understanding and educating is one of the most critical things that we can be doing in the homelessness context, to your question. What can we be doing? How long would it take me to gain any of your trust? How long would it take me to convince you to tell me your social security number and your history of trauma? And then, oh, can you get in this car with me and drive somewhere and let's go tell some people your whole life story, right?
Like, right, it's a long-term effort.
I was there about like 8 minutes into this
You're good?
Conversation. Nice. Yeah, I'm
okay.
Easy.
I got one out of the three. Yeah. So that's the tricky part of this and why it's a process and why it takes time. These are human beings with long histories of trauma and also a long history of promises broken, right? We haven't had the resources to deal with this challenge at any scale, but we've been telling folks for a long time, we're going to get you indoors. We're going to help you get indoors. And we didn't. And so this is why this is not so simple as put a bunch of tents up in all of the parks and get people in there and homelessness will be solved. It's much more complex.
It's true. So let's talk about at the state level. Do you want to go over a few things? So over the last week, we've had some, or the bill blitz. I don't know what we're supposed to call it. Like all the new bills drop or something. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them have to do with housing at the state level, which has been, there's been a lot of things that changed over the last year as far as maybe getting our council members not to deny permanent supportive housing.
Yes.
And so can you talk about, let's talk about a few of the bills. One of them, which just flat out says like a right to shelter bill. Mm-hmm. Is that the type of legislation that we need from the state? And does that make your job easier?
Mm-hmm. It's a great question. And we touched on this a little earlier, and so I'll reiterate and maybe reframe a couple of those points. It sounds right. And morally it feels right. I would like for it to be a right to housing. I would like to reframe that and have it keep us all focused on what the real solutions are, keep us all focused on what the real challenge is. There are 600,000 people in LA County who spend 90% of their income on housing. That's the iceberg under the water. The 52,000 people who are experiencing homelessness is just the tip of the iceberg. And one thing goes wrong for any of those 600,000 people and they become the 52,000. So everything needs to be focused on housing, the cost and availability of housing. And so that's why I think that the right to shelter, while it sounds right as a concept, and our good friends at the AIDS Healthcare Foundation are considering a similar ordinance via ballot initiative here in LA. I've seen a draft of that bouncing around. Sounds right, feels right. New York City, New York State has a right to shelter. Now, weather out there is a big motivator, right? When it's going to be freezing and folks can easily die outside. I totally get and totally understand the need to have, you know, a safe place for everybody to come indoors. But the result is that you have tens of thousands of people who are sleeping on cots every night, 6 inches away from somebody else with all of their belongings stored in a Tupperware bin and at the foot of their bed. Really hard to rebuild your life, really hard to overcome the trauma that you've experienced, really hard to get that stability back.
And they're kicked out for the most part in the mornings and let back in at night,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. Really hard to get your life under control if that's where you're sleeping every night and that's what your existence is. So I would say well-intentioned, but let's make it a right to housing. And I've floated that with some folks saying, how about we propose a sort of companion or response concept to that effect? And the right to housing is something that's been talked about, you know, since FDR proposed it in the second Bill of Rights. So I didn't come up with this on my own here.
Well, at the federal level, too, there's conversations about that as well. So that could be when, you know, we have our new Democratic controlled house.
But that it's highly contingent at this point on the bill that we're discussing, SB 48, put forward by Senator Wiener's office. Is at this point just a shell? There's not any definitions around what constitutes shelter. I feel like those are the details that are necessary to really figure out what would be the cost of actually supplying shelter for everybody who needs it when they request it, and also whether or not that would be a goal that would be something that would be worth striving for our neighbors who don't currently have housing or are at risk of losing housing. Mm-hmm. New York State, which we were talking about a moment ago, has right to shelter as a result of basically a court decision that determined that was something that was covered within the language of the state's code of laws. So, here we have an opportunity to do something different and not just say, like, as you were saying, Tommy, the cots separated with no personal space, no space for your belongings. You have to leave at a specific time in the morning and
split up from your spouse.
Right. Mm-hmm. Those are all things that Senator Wiener has indicated, although the language is not finalized at this point, that he wants to address within the scope of whatever the proposed right to shelter would be here. Again, not a replacement for an actual right to housing, a positive right to housing for all Californians, but potentially something that we could see be developed over the course of next year in 2020, I think.
Yeah, it's an important conversation for everyone to really be engaged with and understand the implications and what it would mean for all the other work that we're doing.
Is there anything you want to plug? Is like, what's your wish list for 2019? Like, what's coming up that you're excited about?
Take away all local zoning control from cities up and down the state.
I think that'll happen.
We're going to have to bleep that.
That'll definitely happen.
I've been on board with that since the beginning.
That's so good. I think that we are getting to a better place. I don't think that will ever happen. And I don't think that a one size fits all strategy is the right way to do it. But I think that we've made big progress. The PSH ordinance that we worked really hard to pass here in LA, which mm-hmm. is being sued by some people in Venice, but the statewide PSH ordinance, which goes into effect on January 1st, which is super exciting, yep. basically makes affordable housing, if at least 25% of it is supportive, by right in the state of California. That's a big deal. That's how you start to...
And by right, we just want to have to keep repeating, means that you can build it without jumping through all the hoops that you right. normally have to
as
do.
And this is an important one, as long as the land is zoned for multifamily housing,
aha.
then you can build it without just pulling the permits at the building department. Now, if there's no land zone for multifamily housing, then you got a problem. So that that's the next chapter, right? And the state has recently passed some bills that are sort of carrots and sticks on zoning more land for multifamily to hit your area's goals for creating multifamily housing. Just keep in mind that 600,000 number.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to see how those work. My hunch is that we'll need to do more on that front.
Yep.
So that's where I would focus that energy. I think the next version of Scott Wiener's 827 that was going to, you know, blow it all up is an interesting evolution. And, you know, we saw a more sort of measured response to this one than the last one.
Yep.
And so I think he's headed in the right direction on that front. I do think that there need to be affordability components of that. And right now there's not. He's sort of leaning on the supply side argument. If we make it easy enough to build, it'll be cheap enough and people can afford it. I don't buy that all the way. I think that there need to be carve outs and requirements for certain levels of income within that. But it's a good bill and it's headed in the right direction. But thank God Sacramento's even having this conversation, right?
Right.
Like
yeah.
for decades, they were like, nope, go talk to your city council and yeah. look where that
goes. Didn't work. And two big things coming up for you guys next year, the homelessness count. Can mm-hmm. you talk a little bit about people mm-hmm. getting involved with that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the homelessness count is such a powerful way to get involved in this in a way that is pretty respectful of people's time. So I know that some of my asks are like, okay, I need to get you like super trained and informed, and then I'm going to need to deploy you to multiple community meetings. And people are like, how could I possibly do that? The homeless count is one night in January. You can do it in the community where you live. And it's incredibly powerful to sort of stop and take a minute to physically tally the people who you see who are living outside. Now, it's not walk up and interview those folks. It is a tally. And so sometimes people are like, I thought we were going to get to like build relationships. There's other ways to do that. But the count becomes the basis for how we allocate our resources. Measure H is allocated by SPA, service planning area, based on the population of folks experiencing homelessness in that SPA. So it's incredibly powerful. The homeless count has gotten better and better every year. People don't realize that we didn't start doing this until 2006, and we didn't start doing it every year until 2011.
Wow, yeah.
We just didn't count. It was made up numbers and guesses for decades. And they're still, Long Beach does it every other year still. The federal requirement is to do it every other year, and the fact that LA does it every year is a big deal. So yeah, that's the end of January. You can sign up, theycountwillyou.org. We'll be pushing that hard when the calendar flips over to January, throw everyone in. It's really powerful. Homeless count went down 4% across the county last year, the first time in 5 years that it had gone down. And so
I did a bad job in my area.
You did?
So that might have been part of it.
I was on you.
Missed
a few. Yeah.
I just know. I get very uncertain about what, like with cars, it's really hard to tell in some cases.
Yes.
It's very fraught.
Luckily, we are now partnering with the good folks, the smart folks at the University of Southern California.
Yeah.
So they take all of the raw data from these volunteers and do smart statistical things to it to help manage things like what you just described.
Smooth out Hayes's margin of error.
Right.
Yes.
And one more thing I thought was pretty cool that everyone is doing is these storytelling nights where you can hear from people mm-hmm. who have experienced homelessness and really put, you know, that humanizing factor mm-hmm. Together.
Yeah. No, thank you for calling those out. I think that's sort of the heart and soul of everyone in. It's an evening really specific to whatever community we are, where we have help folks stand up at a microphone and sort of share their story. It's not just people who've experienced homelessness and are now in stable housing, but that's the core. Usually about 10 speakers and about 7 of them have that history and that experience. But also we always try to have an outreach worker who's on the front line sort of telling their why. This is how we break the stereotypes. This is how we break the myths. And so what we see over and over again, this is backed up by good, you know, social science data. Like when people hear the stories of someone who they feel a connection to, you grew up in that neighborhood and so did this person. You've seen this person for years and now you're hearing a story. All of a sudden the light bulb goes on. So we've done 2 of them so far. We did a Venice storytelling event back in June. Our goal was 175 people, 300 people showed up.
Wow.
We collected all of their contact information.
Yeah.
And then we, you know, reach out to them and hammer them and try to get them to come to future meetings.
Yeah.
And so it's like that's step one of walking people up the ladder on this issue. We did Boyle Heights at the end of November, a really great, powerful evening. We were over there in Mariachi Plaza. I had street vendors from the community come and sort of feed everyone to start. We are taking January off. Hard to pull off an event in January when the holidays lead you right in. But in February, we'll be in Long Beach. Hot conversation going in Long Beach. On Tuesday this week in Long Beach, their Everyone Home Commission, no affiliation, is going to be producing a report that calls for essentially $220 million approved by voters to build housing.
Wow.
And so Long Beach, which is bigger than Sacramento. Mm-hmm. Do you know Long Beach is 590,000 people?
Big. Bigger than Atlanta.
I think we let them off the hook sometimes.
Yeah, forget.
Or we don't give them the attention they deserve. So we'll be in Long Beach in February. We'll be in Pasadena in March. And we'll be in the San Fernando Valley in April. So we're going to be, our goal is to do one of these every month forever. If I'm still standing at that point.
Amazing. We are so happy to have you. Thank you for a very, I think, an uplifting and optimistic outlook as we go into the new year.
Thank you guys for dedicating the time to this conversation.
Thanks, Tommy. Thank you, Tommy. He does a good job of like staying positive and all this stuff for a job that must be very difficult.
That was actually, so that is a very interesting conversation. And I think that he really did a good job of pointing out areas where we're seeing growth. Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, it's always good to keep in mind that our, what we think of as our homelessness crisis is really several different crises, including a housing crisis. So really appreciate it, Tommy.
Yes. And we will be back next week on LA Podcast. Thank you for listening. Bye.